I am your host, DC Hendrix. Appreciate you finding this podcast and taking your time to listen to us here today. We talk all things entertainment industry, all positive things happening. Before we get started, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, everywhere podcasts are available. Make us one of your favorites by subscribing to keep up to date. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, scroll on down, click write a review, and let us know what you are thinking of this show. So we are back here again, and I am still binge watching TV shows, and I found another one, folks. Amazon Prime Video members, check out The Boys. And it's highly acclaimed. It's, you know, obviously taking over headlines. Just got renewed for a season 3 that will come out summer of 2021. And in case you haven't seen this television show, it's based off the comic books. Superheroes are often as popular as celebrities, as influential as politicians, and sometimes even considered as gods. But that's when they're using their powers for good, right? Well, what happens when the heroes start abusing their powers and go bad? So the boys head out on a heroic quest to expose the truth about the 7 superheroes. And just like everything else, there's a multi-billion dollar conglomerate that manages the superheroes and covers up their dirty secrets. And of course, this is based off the comic books, again, written by Garth Ennis and co-created, designed, and illustrated by Derek Robertson. So I'm going to play the latest season trailer for you guys to give you a nice tease of what to expect if you haven't seen the TV show The Boys. And we'll come back with Derek Robertson.
The greatest superhero team the world's ever seen, the 7.
Is there anything I can help you with?
I'm not going to piss you about, Huey. I heard what happened to Robin.
You ain't alone, son. Supes lose hundreds of people each year to collateral damage.
I can't stop.
Robin! That's where me and the boys are coming. Spank the bastards when they get out of line.
Oh my God!
Can you control her, please?
You need to unclench your asshole.
Why are you two carrying on like a bunch of fucking twins?
Who the fuck is this?
We got a fucking job to do.
Motherfuckers.
I'm the world's greatest superhero. I can do whatever the fuck I want. We're on the verge of nailing these wankers.
I'm done.
Oi, what's Sporty Spice up to?
Who?
Sporty fucking Spice, what's she up to?
I don't know.
And baby, not even page 6 of the Daily Mail. You see, when they're apart, they're absolute fucking rubbish. But you put them together, they're the goddamn fucking Spice Girls. The point is, we need each other. We're fucking dead in the water.
Jesus, he gives the worst pep talks.
He really, really does.
I can't do this.
You just pulled the fucking trigger!
We're the 7, Earth's most mighty motherfucker.
Please, 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 no, please.
Pardon my French. Fuck those fuckers.
If you wanna be my lover.
Apologies for the late dial-in. It was away from my desk. I'm like, oh, shit. Didn't even realize what time it was. So I looked up. I'm like, ah, I'm late.
It's all good, man. It's all good. It's COVID times, man. There's no such thing as being late right now. There's no such thing.
Straight up. There's no such thing as time anymore.
That has went out the window a long time ago. But, of course, we got Derek Robertson, the, of course, co-creator of the show The Boys and comic book illustrator. So before we even get to The Boys that I've been watching, binge watching for the last few days or so, before we even get into that, I want to know how you even got started into this. Now, I have, you know, a couple of friends that are also, you know, they got their own books, comic books even. So I'm just curious, you know, is your path any similar? And, you know, how did you get started in creating comic books?
It was kind of a childhood fetish of mine. Like, it was something I used to do just for fun when I would read, I started reading comics when I was, you know, a little kid, and about the time I got to be 9 or 10, I started collecting superhero comics, starting with The Flash, and I just fell in love with the storytelling. So I would try to make my own comic because it was sort of like, I don't know, like seeing somebody do a magic trick. Like, I'm like, how does he do that? How do they do that? So I just found myself, you know, trying to staple, I would staple typing paper together, and I made up my own superheroes and would try to write a story and put panels together. And, you know, and I always wanted it to look as good as what I was looking at, you know, in my real comics. Mm-hmm. And so it was just sort of like a passion. I just wanted to do it so bad. You know, I just kept working at it. So as I got older, my work improved, and I never kind of stopped drawing comics for amusement. And I would entertain myself in high school, pass the time by making comics, for myself. You know, I had no real plan or path to how I was going to get into being a professional, or even thought that I might, but I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And, I got around the time I was 17, I got an opportunity, through a guy I met that, to do a backup feature for an independent black and white comic that was coming out. And I was so excited that I started, you know, working on it very passionately, and it ended up becoming the first issue of my first published comic called Space Beaver. It was during the black and white animal boom of the mid-80s. Hmm. And I wrote and I drew and I, you know, created the covers and did everything pretty much myself with some help from my friends. Hmm. And but when I was putting the backup feature together, the artwork, I showed it to a store owner named Tibor Sardi. I used to go to his comic book shop as a teenager, and he was so impressed. He's like, hey, I'll publish this, and we'll, you know, this shouldn't be a backup feature. This should be its own comic. So he basically put the money in and then set it up and started publishing. It was the only comic that company ever published. But we did 11 issues, and it got me going to conventions and meeting professionals, and I started to learn what I needed to do to break in, and having a published comic helped a lot, because at least it showed that you could, you know, put a whole comic together. Hmm. And from there, I ended up taking pretty much any work I could get, did a lot of commissions, went to conventions and did sketches real cheap, and whatever I could do to just keep working until, you know, I always felt like any job I got was a good job because it was being paid to practice. Mm-hmm. You know, and practice is the only way you can ever get anywhere in the arts. So
that's right.
Just, you got to be like a shark and you just keep swimming. And to this day, I still have the same attitude. Like, okay, I'm always afraid my whatever gig I have is my last gig. So, like, I'm never going to get hired again when this is over. But so anyway, but strangely, I do. But yeah, but that's how I got in. It was a childhood, just a childhood passion. And I had a good teacher in high school, an art teacher, but I didn't really have any, like, you know, professional training. I just,
wow,
you know, just mostly study and practice and, you know, reading good authors like Will Eisner and people that know how to teach sequential storytelling, and listening to, you know, negative feedback as well as the positive.
Mm-hmm.
And then just, you know, you just keep at it until you get better. And I got, you know, I'd like to say I'm lucky, but the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, hard work obviously pays off, as you are now renowned as, you know, one of the top comic book illustrators there is. A debate I always get into, like a friendly debate with my friends and I, even like on Facebook and stuff, as I have a son who is like super into, he's really big into superheroes right now too. He's getting a little bit older, so he's starting to get into drawing them and things like that. He reads comic books. And a debate we get into a lot is, and it's a fun debate, and since I have you, I'm going to give you the floor on this and, you know, learn your, you know, opinions a little bit. So if I were to ask you, who is the greatest superhero of all time? Now, Superman. My opinion, whoa, that was quick. I was going to go Batman because he doesn't have superpowers.
No, that's exactly why he's actually not a superhero.
Ah. Okay, so why is it Superman?
Because he has superpowers, for starters. That's why they call him Superman and not just man. Secondly, he has all the powers. And even though he's not necessarily my favorite superhero, whenever I get asked, who would you want to be if you could be one superhero? I'd go with Superman because, you know, he can fly. He's got super intelligence. He's got breath powers. He's invulnerable. which is a really good thing to go with flight, because if you were, could fly but you weren't invulnerable, hell, that would be scary. But he's got everything. He can do it all. He got super speed. He can race the Flash. You know, what more would you, what more do you want?
Well, Batman can kind of fly. Batman can kind of fly.
What's that?
Batman can kind of fly. He flies. He's a bat.
No, he's got a machine that he can fly in. That's a big difference.
That's true. That's
true. Really, Batman's only superpower, other than being absolutely dedicated and Batman's real superpower is his brain. He's got an amazing brain.
That's right.
If he could figure out how to build this stuff, get this stuff, he's incredibly disciplined. But to me, like, Batman is a hero. Like, he's not a superhero.
I got you.
Because all of his stuff is, like, really his, like, you know, and the old joke is that his superpower is that he's rich, and I think Snyder even threw that into one of his last films. So, and don't get me wrong, though, Batman is absolutely one of my favorite superheroes ever. So, you know, but I love Batman. He's the first action figure I ever got was a Batman figure. And that started my whole love for superheroes. This goes back to Batman. So it's not that I don't love him.
Okay.
But I don't think if you ask me who the greatest superhero of all time is, I have to default to Superman. Another reason is because he started the genre.
That's true.
Like, before there was Superman, there was no such thing as a superhero.
Mm-hmm. I give it to you. I like that. So if I were to flip the script on you and ask you the greatest ultimate villain, who would you say?
Ooh, that's a good one. I'd have to think on it, but if I had to just respond from my gut, the first one that comes to mind is Dr. Doom.
Ooh, yes.
Because I love Dr. Doom because he's tragic, and I think the best supervillains have an element of tragedy to them, and plus he's not, it's like you don't always disagree with him.
Man, you just gave me a good idea. Good idea for dressing up. I've been looking to find something. I only got a few days left to find a Halloween costume. Dr. Doom.
Man, Dr. Doom is awesome. I love Dr. Doom.
Dang it. Yeah, that's a good one.
But actually, I got a soft spot just for his design, and he inspired Darth Vader, who I also think is a great supervillain. But I don't know if we can go into Star Wars as as part of this genre.
That's true. So obviously you've done, so before we even get to The Boys, you've done a couple of other, you know, comic books and things that you've worked on other ones. So before you even got to The Boys, kind of catch us up on what you were working on and what you have done before, because I know you've done some X-Men too, I believe. So catch us up on what you were working on before The Boys.
Before The Boy, oh my God, I had a long career before The Boys. Mm-hmm. I've been working in mainstream comics since around 1992. And so the first job I got, like, fully mainstream was Justice League Europe. Mm-hmm. And so I did Justice League for a little while, and I did some specials and stuff within that time. And then back in the day, if you were working at DC, Marvel would want you, and vice versa. So when I showed Bob Harris my Justice League work, he gave me an audition on Wolverine, and I got it. So my first issue of a Marvel comic ever was Wolverine, which is what I would hoped. I had hoped I would get in and work my way up to. But I got to start at Marvel with Wolverine, working with my friend Fabian Nicieza for the first time, which we would go on to do a long run on a book called New Warriors. And also Spider-Man. I worked on some Spider-Man stuff, including some writing, just minor things. But I did. I wrote a couple of Spider-Man stories and a whole issue of Marvel Team Up with Spider-Man and Gambit that I wrote and I drew. But that was so I got to do. But it was funny because back in that time too, they would always ask me. They would see my Spider-Man work, the current editors, but there was a lot of turnover during the 90s because the industry got really wobbly.
Mm-hmm.
And this just before Marvel declared bankruptcy, but things started going crazy. But every editor I was working with would say, hey, when Bagley leaves Amazing Spider-Man, would you want to take over on Amazing Spider-Man Monthly? And I was like, yes, ooh, please. And they kept asking. And I would go, yes, I'd love that. And then that editor would, like, move on or got laid off or whatever. And then the next guy would come in and then they'd ask me again, hey, would they give me another mini series or something? And I would go, they go, hey, this looks really good. Would you like to do some, would you like to take over on Amazing when Mark Bagley's done? I was like, yes, I'd very much like to do. And it never happened because that person would end up losing their position. And then the next, you know, so finally I ended up, towards the end of my Marvel career in the 90s, I got, there was a company called Malibu Ultraverse, and I co-created some superheroes over there and designed a bunch of them. And of the people, I'm sorry, of the writers I got teamed up with while I worked there, my good friend Hank Canals, who was the editor at the time, he put me together with a guy named Warren Ellis, who was, up and coming. And we ended up doing three issues of a book called Ultra Force. And it was, I loved his script so much that I told him, hey, if you ever want to do a monthly book together, let me know. Hmm. And he liked my work too. So flash forward a couple years later, Marvel's declared bankruptcy. Things are getting weird over there. I had been doing covers and some fill-ins on a book called, I think it was still Marvel Team Up or Spider-Man Team Up. And then Warren reached out to me and said, I have this idea for this new sci-fi line called Helix that DC is going to do, like a sister series to their Vertigo line. And the book was called Transmetropolitan. And he goes, are you interested in getting in on this with me? And we talked about it, and I thought it was a great idea. And I said, yeah, I'll do that monthly. He goes, oh, I was just thinking you might want to start it off, but if you do it monthly, I'll make you a co-creator. And so nice. there, I said yes to that. And then that's when finally Marvel said, hey, do you want to be the monthly artist on the Spider-Man team-up book? Is Spider-Man and another Marvel hero every month? And I was like, oh, God, yes. That would be awesome. You know, it's like I'd still like to have an offer like that. And so I had to really decide, but I ultimately, a good friend of mine gave me, dropped some advice on me, and he said, hey, well, look at it this way. Why don't you try this book, this new thing, and if it takes off, hey, you'll have something that you created, and your name will go above it, but, Spider-Man will still be there if this fails. And I'm like, hey, that's a good point, you could be just another guy drawing Spider-Man, or you can create something. And so I ended up going off with Warren, and we created Transmetropolitan. Mm-hmm. And from there, when I finished Transmetropolitan, I got an offer from Marvel. I was always doing Marvel work in between, too. I did, like, Fury Max with Garth Ennis before we did The Boys and some issues of The Punisher.
Yeah.
And then they asked me, they offered me an exclusive contract and to reboot Wolverine. So I was back to Wolverine with the awesome Greg Rucka, and the two of us rebooted the Wolverine in 2003 with a new number one. And I did that for a while up to around issue 19, give or take a 6-issue break that they brought in another person, but I was still working while that other person was working. So for me, it felt consistent, but and so I was at Marvel for a while. And then when I left Marvel, Garth Ennis had offered to do The Boys about the time I finished Transmet, but I wasn't available. So he asked when I was available again if I'd still want to do it, and I said absolutely. And so we set about creating The Boys, and that came out in 2006.
So take us to that. You know, take us to the moment where, you got The Boys in your mind frame. You know, you're getting ready to work on this. Take us in the room with you, the creative process. What exactly were you, aiming for the audience, the readers, with your issue of The Boys?
Well, it was a long process of a few years while I was still fulfilling my Marvel contract, where the conversation about the comic had begun, and to where we finally got it when it was ready to publish. But I was doing a lot of design work and things like that, and going back and forth some of the original ideas that we had for it. I didn't quite understand what Ennis was going for in the very beginning, and I thought it was going to be more grounded in a superhero universe. So I had designed jackets with like a symbol on the back, and I had like little costume identifiers, because I thought they were more like a legit superhero team, not understanding that no, these weren't a superhero team that fights superheroes. This was just sort of like a gang, and I was like, oh, okay. So when I started to understand more deeply where we were going, and originally it was Ennis's idea was that we were going to take it and make it a part of like the DC universe, the way Hitman was. And we were going to be subtle about how we were like, who the characters were talking about doing awful things. But as we got deeper into it, it became pretty obvious early on that it wasn't going to work that way. And we were much better off creating our own universe and our own superheroes. So we did that as to do a parallel universe, as opposed to trying to sully the characters. And then for me, that's very important. Go back to our conversation about Superman. I was always like, I like to say to people when they go, oh, let's just, obviously that's Superman. I'm like, no, that's not Superman at all. And that makes me mad because Superman would never do the things that Homelander does. In fact, Superman would kick Homelander's ass for doing the things that he does. And that makes a difference because anyone could put on a costume, but that doesn't make you a hero. You know, a hero is what you do with your power, not, you know, not just because you have a hero's costume. So that mattered a lot to me because I love superheroes, and Ennis's approach to them is very different than mine because he never had the same affection for them that I did growing up because he didn't grow up with the superheroes. He grew up with Beano and 2000 AD and these like cool war comics, and those are the things that he would enjoy as a kid in Northern Ireland, whereas, you know, I grew up like Batman and Superman. Those I've been, you know, into those characters since I was a little boy. So I have an affection for him that he doesn't. He just sees the silliness of it. And for me, I can't help but take them seriously. So for me, in that regard, we kind of made a really good yin-yang with the way we approached it. Because when it came time to just to create the boys and we were doing that, I was like, hey, I'm happy just because I am drawing superheroes and I'm drawing stuff that I think is good storytelling as well. So for me, it was the best of both worlds. You know, Garth's an excellent writer and I enjoyed working with him. Mm-hmm. And his scripts are tight. And so it was, and he was always writing something interesting. So it was always, it was fun from both sides. Like I didn't care that the superheroes were doing something awful because to me, again, I wasn't drawing the DCU. I was drawing my own characters.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And that's what I started out doing as a little boy, was coming up with my own superheroes.
Yeah, so digging into some of the characters, you know, within the story, I want to know, because obviously digging into your process again, who was the toughest character to help map out? Now, Homelander, obviously, the big guy, you got Black Noir, you got Billy Butcher, a few that stand out to me that would have been difficult for me, especially Billy Butcher. But for you, you know, as the co-creator, designer, who was the toughest character for you to create?
I really didn't like the original version of the Deep. Darth had a funny idea, and we made him completely ridiculous. All our characters were meant to be ridiculous, and that's one of the things that is sort of funny to me because the show has managed to make them look really cool. But for our approach to it, like I wanted, if I was going to direct the boys the way I originally envisioned it, visually. I was going to have their costumes look like something from the old Batman TV show where it was really obvious it was just a costume.
The Adam West Batman?
Yeah, like the old Adam West Batman from the 60s. Like I wanted those kind of costumes for the superheroes because they were meant to be sort of laughable. That's why you can see when you're reading the boys' comics, that like Butcher has a hard time keeping a straight face around the Seven because he thinks they look like, you know, idiots. So... And I think that's a little bit of Garth projecting, but but at the same time, like it makes sense within the TV universe that they have to be respectable because they, you know, otherwise the story doesn't work. But in our world, so when it came to the Deep, Ennis had a funny idea that he would put this old diving bell helmet on him, and then I thought it would be funny if he had a cape. Because it would, you know, an underwater character with a cape is sort of ridiculous. And so we kind of went back and forth in design, but he was really into that idea of that helmet. And because they imagined he would be, you know, there at the table with the rest of the Seven during a meeting. And they go, what do you think, Deep? And Deep is like, yeah, well, as far as I'm concerned, first of all, you can't really see his face. And, you know, it was ridiculous that he would be able to fight in such a thing because you wouldn't really be able to see. So we were kind of having fun with that character, but drawing a diving helmet over and over again is actually challenging.
Oh, I bet.
So it ended up becoming very unfun. So I didn't like the Deep very much, you know, because it was kind of a gag. So, but it was a lot of work for me to pull off like a gag of him just because he'd sit there silently at the table. And I'd still have to draw that helmet. So anyway, so that would be the worst one. Everybody else, I pretty much enjoyed. The Homelander's Eagle was a challenge, too, because that was supposed to be a little nod to Judge Dredd.
Yeah, and I did an interview before. I interviewed Carolyn Kepnes, who's the author of the U-Books, the show You on Netflix. So I wanted to ask you the same question, because I'm always so interested in how you were even approached. Like, hey, love your comic book, want to make a TV show out of it, Amazon original. How did that process pan out?
Well, actually, it was a very long process. So in 2008, after we got canceled at Wildstorm, because DC, the higher-ups at DC at the time found the book too controversial to have in their line of books, because you'd have ads for Batman and Justice League in between all the horrible stuff the boys were doing, and they made the people that were... It was selling like crazy, though. It was kind of a weird choice, because it's like, hey, this is a hit. Let's get rid of it. So, but they were very gracious about giving us the rights back and made it as smooth a transition as possible, and... So I have nothing but nice things to say about how DC handled it, other than it was a little harrowing to get canceled after kind of committing to a 5-year series and like having seeing it sell like mad, and it was burning up the internet and as far as people talking about it. And then they're like, well, we can't do this. Like, what? But it was it was a couple misunderstandings along the way. But the point is, they gave us the rights back. We moved over to Dynamite Comics, where we're still being published there today, at least the reprints. And they had, in about 2008, Hollywood came knocking. So it was a company called Kickstart, headed up by Neil Moritz, who's known for a lot of great franchises, including The Fast and the Furious. Mm. He has an entire TV arm of his business. And so he's done a lot of great stuff. He found it at a meeting, apparently, and really just fell in love with it and came to get the rights almost immediately. So In 2008, it was optioned, and we were almost a movie trilogy. Hmm. We were getting set up for that at Sony. Mm-hmm. And then the tsunami hit, and Sony lost like $11 billion in a quarter because of the tsunami. So they had to Sony Pictures wasn't making anything. So it went into what they call turnaround. And it was a shame, because Adam McKay, who is now an Oscar winning writer director, he was attached to it, and we got to be friends, and he showed me what he was going to do with it. And it would have been awesome, but never got the green light. So they do. There's a thing in Hollywood called, I learned all this through experience and heartbreak, but it's called turnaround. And it's when they take an option, they let an option lapse and they put it out in the market. Somebody else can option it at that point. Paramount stepped up right away and optioned it. And then they didn't do anything with it for 2 years, even though they had Adam McKay could have worked on it. I still don't know why, but I think studios were eager to get it and then afraid of it once they had it, because they were afraid it wouldn't work, because, you know, a lot has changed since 2008. But this was around 2011 or 12 that they went and turned around. And then, so we just kept waiting for this to get made. Finally, I just gave up on it. And I was like, it's never going to happen. I'm going to move on with my life and stop thinking about it and stop waiting on it. So I did. And, but then I got word that, the person that works with Neil Moritz's name is Henri Corman, and Henri is a friend. Oh no, Ori. His name is Ori, and he's a friend of Eric Kripke's. And they got to talking about how, I guess Eric Kripke was telling him how much he loved the comic, and then it turned out like, oh yeah, we have that optioned. And he was like, wow. I want to make that. And so this is the point. I'm a long-winded, I apologize, but this is the point. Eric Kripke loved the comic, and when he found out it was available to make into something, he made things start to happen to where it got into his control, and that's why there's a show. So if Eric Kripke wasn't in love with the comic, it probably would still be out there in limbo at this point.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
So it really just comes down to having somebody who wants to champion it. And Eric Kripke really wanted to make this show. And it shows. It's a great show. He does terrific. He made an amazing television series.
To get cliche and corny, it only takes one person to believe in you.
It helps if you got a whole, you know, series of comic books published that they could love. But absolutely.
That's right. Yeah. And you were... and obviously, yeah, you mentioned that this show is doing phenomenal, like almost a 9 out of 10 rating on IMDb. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
So I wanted
the response has been unbelievable. I've never, I was, when they first released it, or it was about to get released, Amazon had just canceled The Tick. And so I was like, oh, geez, I hope we don't get canceled right away. I hope this thing gets a chance to find its audience. You know, I was not prepared for the response to this at all. So the response has just been overwhelmingly good. And I just see it, everything just come together, because there's a lot of good people working on this show that I'm just happy for them, if that makes sense. I mean, I get my piece of it and it's good for me and all, but I know the hard work that's going in behind the scenes, from the people that make the costumes, from the people that do the makeup, from the people in the art department, all these people working together. And then this incredible cast, just to see all these people and their hard work getting recognized and rewarded is really, really makes me happy.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, it's based off the comic book. So I always like this question as well, because, you know, reading both the comic book and watching the TV show, you know, for you, what are the most glaring differences? Now, for someone that's listening right now that is either or read the comic book and not watched the TV show, or someone that's watched the TV show and not read the comic book, what are, from you, you know, what are the biggest differences between the show and the book?
Well, the show is, it's more, I was hearing Kripke himself talk about it the other day on a podcast. He said it really well. It's like the show, it's more intended for, I think it hits a broader audience, in a good way. There are things that we did in the comic that I think is just would be too far over the top for the show, but the show definitely goes there in a lot of places. But at the end of the day, I think that they're trying to create their own universe, and they're picking from the comic. They're not doing the comic verbatim. So it's not like it's exact. I mean, there are moments. It was when I first met Kripke, was in San Diego, Comic-Con a few years ago before he started writing the pilot. And we sat down and we talked about, you know, he asked Ennis and I separately, like, what do you want to see in this? Like, what's important to you? And I was so impressed that he even asked.
Right.
Because a lot of times these productions happen, and you're lucky if you even get to see, you know, a screener before it releases, much less be involved. But Kripke was like, what's important to you? And I said, it's got to be funny. If it's not funny at all, it's going to be a long, hard slog, and you're going to lose everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if you keep the humor and you find the humor, that's really the little bit of sugar that makes the medicine go down. And he agreed, and he's got a great sense of humor, clearly. But then I also said, there's a scene that I really believe needs to be in the pilot. And I've been saying this since it was a movie property. I go, you have to have the scene where Huey, and this is when I thought Huey was going to look like he did in the comics and be Scottish and everything. But I said, there's a scene where Huey's holding the hands of Robin right after she gets murdered. And if you don't have that moment in there, I think you're going to lose your audience. But if you do, you're going to get all the fan love, because everybody loves the comics and is going to recognize what that beat is. And he's like, oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a great suggestion. And so he made sure it was in there. And then Dan Trachtenberg, who directed the pilot, came in and added this element of this, like, slow motion blood splatter and all this. Like, the way he directed it was just phenomenal. And it's a great example of how things work differently on TV than they do on a comic book page. And he, by him drawing it out and this slow, like this incredible slow motion blowback, that's like a defining moment of in and of itself for the series now, rather than just something that came from the comic. And then of course Jack Quaid's performance there is just phenomenal. So, it's one of those things, like, because it's true to the comic and yet they made it their own. And that's what I would say is indicative of the entire series. So you can read the comic and there won't be a whole lot of spoilers for the show, because they're already going their own path with this. Like, the way, I'm trying not to give out any spoilers for people who haven't seen season two, but the way season two ended is there's an homage to the comic, but they did it in their own way. And I thought that was really cool. Like, in the fact that they did things like taking Stormfront and making her female, and casting Aya Cash in that role, like, that was an interesting choice that is different than the comics. So they're doing their own thing with it. But I think the where it matters, they're very true and faithful to what made the comic tick. Mm-hmm. So the themes are there and the relationship dynamics are intact. All those things work, and there's a lot of like backstory that comes from the comic. You know, like the fact that they mention Butcher's brother Lenny, and that was a character from the comic. You know, little things like that that makes me know that they at least know the source material that they're lifting from before they make their changes to it. They aren't just like, oh, yeah, we'll just call it The Boys and then do our own thing. Like, if you ever watched the old 1970s Spider-Man series, the first episode of that is hilarious because you can tell it's like a TV writer that was like writing for stuff like Kojak at the time, and they like, hey, write Spider-Man. So he wrote a police story and kind of worked Spider-Man into it, kind of. But the whole thing is like really, like Spider-Man could never have showed up, and it would have been the same story.
Oh, Kojak, that took it back. That took it back
a
little bit.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, this show is just doing phenomenal things, and obviously your comic books have triggered that. Just a fantastic story, and, you know, Seth Rogen approves. Helping put this together. What has that meant for you too, having Seth Rogen behind this too?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, I was a big Seth Rogen fan before. Absolutely. You know, I actually ran into years ago, around, I think it was around 2010 or 11, back when the comic was still going to be a movie property. I got invited to this San Diego Comic-Con party that I had no business being at, but I ended up showing up, and there was like a lot of people there, a lot of famous people at this party, and one of them was Bill Hader. And so I ended up talking to Bill Hader for a while, and he was asking me what I do, and I told him I'm going to do this comic book called The Boys. I was still drawing it then. And he goes, oh, Seth loves your comic. So this is like years before he was even involved, but he was telling me emphatically, oh, no, Seth loves your comics. He's going to want to meet you. He's on his way. And I'm like, yes, great. I'm going to meet Seth Rogen. Been a big fan of his since like Freaks and Geeks, you know. I was like, I go way back as a Seth Rogen fan. So I was super happy that he knew the comic and was, you know, coming to this party. And literally 5 minutes later, like the lights came up, like, and they were very strict. They're very strict at the San Diego, you know, venues. They were like, everybody has to go now. Thank you for coming to the party. Like, oh, that's not here. So I didn't get to meet him then, but I did meet him last year in San Diego Comic-Con at the panel. And he's real nice. He's like, I'm a big fan. And so, you know, I'm thrilled that he too is one of the champions as to why it got made. You know, when you have a powerhouse like that as a producer,
That's right.
You know, not a lot of people are saying no to Seth Rogen these days. And on top of that, he loves the comic, and that comes through. So, again, there's a lot of love for the source material, and they've treated me very well. The production team on the show have been very kind to me. So it's been very gratifying. It's sort of like a little bit of a dream come true for a little kid who taught himself to draw, you know.
That's right. Absolutely amazing journey. Everything's coming together, already renewed for a season 3.
And a spinoff in the works.
That's right. See, it's all kind of stuff working for you. But before we get out of here, I want to give you the floor a little bit, and don't have to go too far into detail, but a quick, nice little tease for season 3.
This is from the God's honest truth. I have no idea what they're going to do for season 3 yet.
Okay. All right.
So
okay.
I don't write it. I get to be, they send me the scripts when they're ready and approved.
Okay.
Mostly when I ask, but I haven't, you know, I think everything's been kind of delayed, because of COVID. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know where they are in the writing at this point. But I did hear that Love Sauce is just going to make another appearance.
Okay. There it is. That's all we need. Boom. Season 3, that's all we need. I'm going to add some sound effects in there, too, to make that, give it a little extra oomph. Absolutely great stuff.
Everybody needs a little Love Sausage. So.
That's right. The Boys, Derek Robertson joining us here. Of course, he was the co-creator and illustrator for The Boys comic books, and he joins us here today. Derek, thank you so much for coming on. You know, really glad to, you know, dig into this TV show and your books. Keep it up, and look forward to seeing more work from you and hopefully talking to you again, man. Great stuff.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to talk to you again. It's been a pleasure.